He was growing into manhood. Less than 6 months remaining, he said to himself as he checked the navigation display. We're on our way back to Ceres. Will we make it? He remembered seeing an old novel about a man who tries to go around the world, Earth, of course, in 90 days. Or was it 80? The story was set a couple of centuries ago, and at one point the character is sailing across the Atlantic Ocean in a steam-powered ship. But they run out of coal for the steam boiler, so he has the crew cannibalize the ship's wooden structure, tearing the planks apart until there's nothing left above water but the ship's steel skeleton, its boiler, engine, and paddle wheel. That's what we're doing, Theo told himself, cannibalizing old Syracuse as we limp back to port. It's a race to see if we can get to Ceres before the old bucket falls apart. 167 days, he read off the ship's navigation computer screen. If my calculations are right, if I haven't messed up somewhere, 167 days to go. Theo had taught himself a fair amount of astronomy over the past 3+ years. With all the ship's antennas out, he could not receive guidance signals from Ceres or anywhere else. Nor could he probe ahead with radar. It was impossible to determine where the ship was, or even its heading, through the ordinary electronic systems. So Theo learned the stars from the ship's library and learned to navigate by them. Using the stars, he kept Syracuse on its course back to Ceres. He hoped. At the moment, his attention was focused on their dwindling water supply. He had strictly rationed the water he, his sister, and mother used. Angela had accused him of being a tyrant more than once, but Mother had merely smiled and accepted his estimates of how much water they could afford to use for drinking, for cooking, for bathing. The recyclers aren't perfect, he told his sister time and again. We're losing water every day. And without water for the fusion reactor, their electrical power would fail. No electricity meant death. No power for the air recycler. No lights. No heat. They would freeze in the dark. Or suffocate. So Theo shut down the sections of the ship they weren't using. Only this backup command pod and their living quarters received electrical power and breathable air. And the tube tunnels connecting them. The rest of the ship was dark and airless. The water recycler. It was Theo's daily burden. Every day he climbed down the tunnel to the equipment bay where the fusion reactor sat side by side with the recyclers and the now dormant main propulsion engine. Every day he nursed the cranky collection of pipes and filters, cleaning its grids tenderly, patching leaks in the connection seals, stealing sections of pipe from other parts of the ship, and cannibalizing parts for the recycler's electrical motors. He dreamed at night that he was trapped in the maze of piping, sloshing in water that was spurting from the recycler, going to waste, gushing across the deck and out into empty space. Once he dreamt that the water's inexorable current carried him outside the ship, too. He woke in a cold sweat, shivering, and berated himself for wasting the water of his perspiration. Angela stepped through the hatch of the command pod. "Reporting for duty," she said, with a crisp salute and a challenging grin. Theo glanced at the digital clock. "You're 3.5 minutes early, Angie." "Early bird gets the worm," she said. "But who wants worms?" They both laughed. Theo got up from the command chair, and Angela slid into it lightly. They had all lost weight on their enforced diet, but Angie had slimmed down best of all. She looked fine to Theo, a real beauty now. "Any problems?" she asked, her eyes scanning the control board. Most of the telltale lights were dark now. Only the systems they absolutely needed for survival were still functioning. "Everything's percolating along," Theo replied. "Mom's got a problem with the microwave again," Angie said. "She thinks she can fix it, but you ought to give her a hand." "Gotcha," said Theo. "After I check the beast." Angie looked up at him. "Trouble again?" "No, but if I don't look in on that glorified clanker every spitting day, it springs leaks just to devil me." "Maybe it misses you. Maybe the recycler loves your company." "Sure, and maybe water falls out of the sky. But not here."
Aboard Vogeltoat, Falker was facing a grumbling crew. "You never should let him go in the first place," said Nico. He was a short, swarthy man with a thick mop of curly black hair and the faint trace of a scar running from the corner of his mouth across his cheek. Falker's usual smile faded. If Nico's pissed at me, he thought, the rest of them must be ready for mutiny. Behind him, the others of the crew, all eight of them, nodded and muttered agreement. They had all jammed into the galley for this showdown, leaving Vogeltoad cruising on automatic. The compartment felt steamy from the press of their bodies. Falker smelled sweat and anger. "It's been 6 goddamn months," Kirk said, his voice almost breaking with pent-up resentment. 6 months with nothing in our pocket. Nothing. Falker put on his brightest smile for them. "Come on, guys. We've had dry spells before." "We had them and their ship in our hands," Kirk insisted, pounding the palm of one hand with his other fist. "The captain of the Viking, too. And you let them go." Sitting at the head of the galley's narrow table, Falker leaned back, seemingly completely at ease. "Now look," he said. "That Viking was an attack ship. Do we want to tangle with a ship that can blow us away like that?" He snapped his fingers. Nico and several of the others shook their heads. "Besides," Falker went on, "it was a Humphrey Space System ship. Even if we could have knocked it off, we'd have HSS after us." "You want that?" "No," Nico said hesitantly.
"But what about the other one?" Kirk demanded. "Hunter. It wasn't armed. Nobody aboard her but that old woman and the cyborg.
A whole ship intact.
And you let them go."
"That's what we're after," Falker said. "That's the one we're looking for.
For 6 goddamn months."
Spreading his arms, Falker said,
"It's been a lean 6 months, I know. If we'd run across something else, we would have taken it. You know that. But this region's been pretty damned empty."
"Then we ought to move to an area where there's better pickings."
"You're right," Falker said smoothly. "That's just what I intend to do. I hate to give up on Hunter, though. She could have fetched a pretty penny for us at Ceres."
6 months is long enough."
"Too long."
"Okay, I hear you,"
Falker said to them. "Just give me another few days. If we don't find Hunter by then, we'll move to another sector."
"Not in a few days," Kirk said, baring his teeth. "Now."
Falker broadened his smile.
"You're not giving me orders on this ship, Kirk."
"I am."
"Well, maybe we ought to change that."
Slowly, Falker got to his feet. He stood a good 6 centimeters taller than Kirk.
"If you want to
contact," boomed the computer's synthesized voice over the intercom speakers in the galley's overhead. "Contact with an unidentified ship." Falker held up a clenched fist.
"There you are, guys. We found her."
Cargo ship Pleiades, Solar Storm. Although Victor Zacharias cruised through the asteroid belt in silence, emitting no signals that another ship could detect, except an occasional microsecond pulse of search radar, he still listened to whatever chatter Pleiades' antennas could pick up. Sometimes he thought the only thing that kept him from outright madness as he sailed alone through the empty months was the inane entertainment broadcast from Earth and the Moon. He was leaner now, harder. His years of enforced labor on Chrysalis II had toughened not only his outlook, but his body as well. His arms were hard ropes of muscle, his midsection flat and firm. The midnight black beard he had grown made him look satisfyingly menacing, he thought. "I'll shave it off when I find Pauline and the kids," he told himself. He sat alone in the galley, his soft-booted feet propped up on one of the swivel chairs, and watched an educational vid from Cellini. An earnest young scientist was walking the viewer through the new liquid mercury optical telescope at the Farside Observatory. With a pang of memory, Victor saw the original Farside facility that he had helped to design, the 10-kilometer square spread of dipole antennas that made up the main radio telescope, the old 20-meter reflectors spun from lunar glass, the labs and workshops and dormitory facility for the